What's up, mi gente? I'm Juan Ayala from Latin Babbler Show, and you're listening to Latin Arte, where we bring you exclusive interviews with rising Latin stars of the world. ¿Listos? ¡Vamos!
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Latin Arte. I'm your host, Juan Ayala, and joining me once again as my co-host is Silvia, a.k.a. Cosmo Latina.
Hola!
And today's guest is Florencia Lozano, an actress, writer, and producer who you've seen across film, television, and theater, including iconic series like General Hospital, One Life to Live, and Narcos, to name a few.
Gracias. Thank you so much. It's so happy to be here. Florencia is also the co-writer, producer, and star of the new film Life After You, which follows a family grieving the sudden and tragic death of their 19-year-old son, shining a light on the misuse and addictions to opioids and the ongoing opioid crisis in the U.S.
So, Florencia, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here and for this very, very powerful film. Both Sylvia and I both had a chance to watch, and we'll get into it in a bit, but just absolutely incredible.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for watching it and for asking me to join.
Absolutely.
Lorenza,
before we dive into the film, let's go back to your earlier years as an actress. How did all of that start for you? And what was it like coming up as an actress?
I was the youngest of three daughters, and I kind of felt like the stage was the only place that I could exist in a way. My parents are immigrants from Argentina, and there was a lot going on in my house. And I felt like the only way I could kind of compete was when I was on stage. I remember doing a play in third grade, and when the audience applauded, I felt like this, like, love and approval, like, and it was like a drug. I remember that feeling of being on stage and being like, oh, like, it was the most powerful feeling. And yeah, I kind of been chasing it ever since, you know, just shamelessly. Like, I love existing on stage and feeling like I can communicate something there.
Absolutely. And I recall that when you were shooting your hospice scenes in One Life to Live, it supported another project you were working on. Can you tell us about how you manage working multiple projects?
Oh, thank you so much for mentioning that. That was so exciting, because I was getting to, I had written a play, and it was being produced in New York while I was in a coma on One Life to Live. So it was kind of amazing to get to do both of those things simultaneously, to be able to, you know. When I first got to New York, I connected with whatever Latino theater artists were, because I grew up in a place where, I grew up outside of Boston, and I grew up in a mostly Jewish, upper middle class suburb of Boston. And I didn't know many Latinos, and I just felt like we were different, which, you know, as a teenager is kind of the worst thing you can be. My parents wanted us to speak Spanish, and I'm so glad that they insisted, but we hated to at the time, because I felt like it made us different. We had dinner later than everybody else. We ate different foods. My parents were very much like, what happens in this family stays in the family. And then, there was a real distance between us and I felt like the people around us. So I was longing to join a community of people who spoke Spanish, who, you know, I mean, it sounds kind of cliche, but like who liked to dance, you know, who had some of the same cultural things that I did. And when I got involved with theater here, I started writing. And I had always written short stories and stuff, but I had read this novella called Requiem for a Woman's Soul. And it was by a Chilean journalist who had a lot of experience talking to people who had disappeared and the families of the people who disappeared in Chile in 1973 when Pinochet came to power. And I had grown up hearing my father talk a lot about what was happening in Argentina during the Dirty War from 1976 to 1984. 30,000 people were disappeared. My mother's family was all still in Argentina. And it was very much a world in which, you know, if you said something, you were endangering your life. So I remember hearing my parents argue about, you know, how can your family not say anything when people are being taken? And my dad was very explicit about, you know, the sort of torture that was happening there. And so as a young girl, I had a lot of anxiety about that stuff. And the great thing about writing is that oftentimes your greatest fears and your greatest griefs are hilariously funny when you know, there's this alchemy that happens when you come out with whatever you're ashamed of or terrified of. So many people have similar huge fears and tremendous shame. And there's such catharsis in being able to reach out and not feel alone. There's a very specific kind of joy that happens with that kind of release. And there was also just a lot of humor to growing up with two older sisters in an immigrant family where Argentina felt like it was part of our house. Like it was intruding on our house. It was overlapped. It was like two realities at the same time. And that's what I tried to do with the play, you know, Spanish and English, Argentina, New England, the mores of that place and the culture of this place. And so, yeah, in the play, I imagine a girl imprisoned in Argentina living underneath my bed. And because I really thought, you know, what if we had never left? Like, what if my parents had never left? Like, that would have been us. So that's sort of what I played out in the play.
So much of what you're, you know, so I'm connecting so much with your story because I also was a first generation American. My parents both immigrated from El Salvador, also fleeing the war in the 80s. And similarly, so I'm also an actor in addition to the journalism and writing that I do. And similarly, you know, going back a little bit, sort of being on stage, you know, also like being on stage was kind of like a little escape for me where I felt like I could fit in. And yeah, like what you just said about sort of your upbringing in this play and like sort of the two worlds colliding, that's so much of what I felt like I experienced because it was very much like we were in Connecticut. Could you get more New England than Connecticut? Like, come on. But but, you know, I also didn't really like speaking Spanish much. Again, parents insisted we went to a Spanish church. So there was just all these different aspects of the culture sort of meshing together. Yeah. And then I'm going to school, an American school, speaking English. Yeah, I'm just connecting so much with what you're saying, really. It's I hope that has the play been put on? Has it been published or produced elsewhere after it premiered?
So, you know, it's cool because it was produced in New York City. It was given a gorgeous production. Actually, Pedro Pascal, now the Mandalorian, he directed it. No way. Yeah, this was before he started. Love. Yeah.
And I knew him when.
Totally. And, you know, his family had a very similar situation. His parents went underground when El Golpe hit in 1973. Literally, like, he as a small baby was transferred from one aunt's house to the to another uncle's house because his parents had to really go off the radar. So when I read, I remember reading him the first scene of the play, and he was like, "I want to direct this. I want to direct this." And he's an amazing actor, but he directed the hell out of this. It was a really hard play. There was a moon in the play. There was sort of two separate realities living at the same time. So there's a lot of Spanish in the play. And what I heard back from publishers was there's too much Spanish. And it's funny because I saw West Side Story last night. Mm. And, you know, I think there's more and more, and I think we're going to see this more and more. Spanish is just part of this culture now. And we are part of this culture. Like, my whole thing is like, well, maybe people need to learn Spanish. Like, you know, learn another language, perhaps, or don't understand and like understand what it feels like to not understand, because that's that's how a lot of people negotiate this country. So my hope is that it will be published, and I'm going to keep trying to get it published. But the Spanish was the obstacle.
Ooh, repertorio español. I'll campaign for you. Repertorio español. And we have theaters here in LA. I'll talk to friends like, what, let's get this, because I feel that all three of us are non-dominant cultures in this country. I am Guatemalan Ecuadorian, grew up with loads of Mexicans. The Salvadorans came, but like still Guatemala and Ecuador, like some what, huh? Like we're all Mexican in LA, you know?
Why, of course.
So to hear these stories that are different, I mean, yeah, we can be united as a people, but we also have our own cultures and experiences, and it's important to have them out there.
Yes.
Let's campaign.
I love it. I love it.
And with this latest project with Life After You, it's based on a novel of the same name. And it's, again, it's so incredibly powerful. I'm so happy that we got to see it before chatting with you about it. And, you know, it's unfortunate that the majority of people know someone who's dealt with substance use issues or addictions or anything. And so many people will be able to relate to the film in that way. We've all sort of seen something like that go down. And you co-wrote the script with Sarah T. Schwab. So how did the whole project come about?
So Charlene Giannetti, who is a producer on the film, she's a journalist, and she interviewed Linda Latterman, who wrote the novel Life After You, What Your Death from Drugs Leaves Behind, which started as you see in the movie, it started as a Facebook post that she wrote in the middle of the night, actually a month after her son Danny passed in February of 2014. She was just at her wit's end and couldn't sleep. As it shows in the movie, every time she would close her eyes, she would see her son's face when, you know, the way he looked when they found him. Because again, in the movie, you see that Danny overdosed in his bedroom, in his childhood bedroom. And he was doing heroin, you know, right in the house. And so she wrote this Facebook post that went viral and ended up finding a sense of mission in connecting with others and saying, hey, I have to say something, because kids are dying. You know, specifically with Danny, there was fentanyl in the batch of heroin that he OD'd on, and which unfortunately has become more and more prevalent. Now it's being found in pretty much all drugs across the board. So, you know, specifically, we were really trying to raise an alarm bell with kids and say, look, with everyone, but specifically with teenagers who, you know, who don't have a sense of their own mortality in the way that we tend to as we grow older. And, you know, kids experiment and they're kids. And we were trying to say, look, there are drugs on the street that you can try them once if they're laced with something like fentanyl, you will die. It's different than the landscape of drugs that were available when I was a teenager, you know? So, and Linda was really trying to scare kids with her book. Charlene published Linda's book, and she wanted to make a film of the book because she wanted more people to hear this story. And she wanted me on board. She had seen my work as an actress, and she wanted me to play Linda. And after talking to Linda a bit, I asked Charlene if I could have a stab at writing the screenplay, because I wanted it to not be a traditional linear sort of like, this is what happened after Danny's death. I wanted it to be more of an emotional journey of what happens to each family member. How do they all deal with the grief of this loss? And in the mother's case, in Linda's case, how does she hold on to her son because of a refusal to be able to let go of the guilt, the enormous guilt involved, and just the pain of having lost her son. And I brought Sarah on board to co-write it with me and direct it because she's a great screenwriter. I had seen a short that she directed, a 10-minute short. And in 10 minutes, I was just in tears after watching it. And I thought, she has the technique and the vision to bring this story to light in a way that is not melodramatic, because we always, you know, fear stepping over that line of having it be too exploitive, we wanted to really honor his memory and be able to get through to people without pushing them away. The story is so sad that we had to be careful about that.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because what I noticed that sets this film apart from so many other films that I've seen is the strength in the silence and movement. The power to act through emotion. How did this compare to your other roles?
Well, I should say a lot of that is Sarah too. Like, it was really interesting being part of the process of making a film, because, you know, unlike theater, so much of it, well, I should say theater is a lot about editing too, but that's before you get to the actual performance. You know, once you've shot a film, so much of it is editing. And she chose takes that were restrained. You know, she chose to honor silence, to honor less is more. And that's really her vision, her style, her temperament. And I feel like it served the story really well. I went into this, and I have to say, every step of the way, I was full of self-doubt, because it was such a enormous task to honor this kid's memory, this real live person and the real live family that was left behind. I got to tell you, we made a lot of mistakes along the way. Like, and I want to say to anyone who wants to make anything, like, that's part of the process. Like, you don't have to be perfect. You just have to do your best. And, you know, the mistakes that we made taught us how to do it better next time. We wrote many drafts of this. we got a lot of notes from a lot of people. Linda, you know, had issues with some of the early drafts. You know, it was really trial and error. And working with a team of people who could support one another, because so much of the time I was like, what are we doing? How are we going to do this? Like, I'd never written a screenplay before. I'd never co-written with anyone. I'd never produced anything. So it was a real leap of faith. And in terms of approaching the role, I tried to trust that I didn't have to push, and that I could access grief. And, you know, we were working in a community where literally so many of the people that were extras, the maids who worked in the hotel we were staying at, they were either survivors of addiction, they were in recovery, they had stories about loss. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to like receive all of this human experience and try to channel it and tell this story, because it's unfortunately so many people's story. And that's what I tried to do.
And with the film, you know, so many projects like this that touch on social issues or medical issues, substance abuse, anything, are often used for educational purposes. Do you see this film being something that can be used by like nonprofit organizations or in schools or recovery programs?
Oh yeah, I mean, hugely. Like, what we really want with this film, part of our mission with the film is really igniting conversations within specific communities. Because each community, this epidemic manifests in different ways, and different populations have different needs and different experiences. And so we had several screenings of this film in different places, different states. And we partnered with recovery organizations there who talked about everything from the statistics to the populations that they were, working with to, just, you know, the face of it in their community. We had people in recovery talk about how the film addresses things that they've been through. And we were really eager to hear the voices of people who knew this story from a very personal vantage point. Listening to those talkbacks was, for me, was just such a huge gift, because it's rare that in a public setting with people you don't know, people are willing to be so vulnerable and talk about their personal loss, their personal journey, like coming out of the pandemic into these conversations. Live conversations felt like such a gift, because we're all so raw with grief, with, like, you know, isolation, which unfortunately has made this pandemic, the opioid epidemic, so much worse. We have partnered with Canopy, which is an educational distribution company, and they are going to be showing this film in high schools, in colleges, in all kinds of educational settings. So yeah, that's a huge part of our mission with the film.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
Fantastic.
On that.
Fantastic. Wow.
Thank you.
Well, Florencia, you've conquered soap opera, dramas, theater. What is an area that you still want to explore?
Oh, geez. You know, I'm really interested in how writing can help people in terms of people telling their own stories and how they can exist. They can write themselves into existence, you know, and they can see themselves and hear themselves reflected back as people who are. Sometimes I have a lot more compassion for myself when I write something and I think, oh shit, she's trying so hard. This girl, this woman is doing the best she can. And she's funny and she's human, you know, and sometimes I don't think we realize that we are precious creatures unless we are able to find some distance from oneself. So I'm hoping to, you know, be involved in initiatives where I you know, I help people to discover that, like, superpower, the superpower of writing yourself into existence, especially as Latinos, you know. We are pigeonholed in so many ways. Our stories are being told in such a limited scope at times. And it's exciting to see the individuality of each culture, of each person, of each experience. It's so rich, and I really want to continue to be part of that expansion of our understanding of what it means to be an immigrant, a child of immigrants, you know, and a citizen of the world.
And before we wrap up, so for any of the young actors or artists who may be watching or tuning in, what advice do you have for them going into this crazy career?
You know, sometimes when I'm asked that, I think advice is so easy to give and it's so hard to take. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've recently begun meditating, and it's really helped me. Every person is different. So it's hard to give advice for, you know, for everyone. But when I was younger, I couldn't bear it. You know, it was way too terrifying to sit in silence. But there's something about sitting in silence that I feel like allows me to realize that I'm enough. I'm enough just the way I am, you know, and my job is to, like, be here and hear the sounds of the traffic and, like, exist in this moment, you know, because, like, life is precious. So.
Man, that hit hard. So it's been, you know, being an actor, and especially being an actor of color from a marginalized community, is so frustrating because it's so rewarding, but it's also so frustrating because it's like so many of the stories that we see are, like you said, they're very pigeonholed and very almost a little tone deaf sometimes because the right people are not writing those stories and not telling those stories from our perspectives. And you know, it can be very difficult for especially young actors today finding a place where they belong because they may not fit into the stereotype that, like, I don't think I've ever actually been cast as Latino my entire career. It's because I don't fit the drug, like, I don't look like a drug dealer on Law and Order or
God. Any, you
know, I don't fit into that scope or whatever. Right. And it's only the shows that I've been very fortunate, like during pilot seasons and whatnot, that I'll get auditions like, oh, this was written by a Hispanic person. This was, the showrunner is Hispanic and they get it, or it's cast by a Hispanic casting team. And it's like, they get it. We don't all look one way. You know, yes. We come in all different shapes and colors and sizes and everything. And it's just, it's really wonderful seeing how the industry is changing. And I'm sure with your career, you've noticed how vastly it has changed just year after year.
Yeah. It has, and it will keep doing so. We are at obviously a very tumultuous time, but I think it's an exciting time. I think things are changing, things are shifting. Evolution is real. And I would say, you know, just to add on to that, like, build your community. Find your people, like what you guys are doing, like creating something out of nothing. You guys decided to be partners and decided to, you know, interview people, like what you guys are doing, which is just, I am going to put something in the world, you know? And you can do that with the people that you feel like, all right, this is someone who I like, who is talented. I'm going to write something for that person. And then we're going to have a reading in my house and we're going to invite some people and it's going to be a thing, you know, that's, we have to sort of empower ourselves as opposed to waiting for the project that drops into our lap with great parts for us. We need to write ourselves into existence, make yourself a casting director. I mean, that's one of my favorite jobs is like, If I can't do something or if I hear about a project, I'll say, you know, here are five actors who are awesome. Mm-hmm. And, you know, making those connections, networking. So you're part of this huge spider web that like makes you all stronger. Yeah. It feels like a good way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And really sort of vouching for each other. Is in sort of paying it forward that way is such a wonderful lesson. Well, Florencia, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today and for bringing this very powerful story to life. I really can't wait for audiences to see it.
Thank you guys so much. It does, tomorrow it's available on like Apple and iTunes and pay-per-view and stuff. So I hope people watch it. Thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to talk about it and for creating this podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. And so if anyone would like to give you a follow on social media or anywhere, where can they find you?
So my Instagram handle is my name, all lowercase with an underscore between Florencia and Lozano.
Awesome. And folks, as she said, Life After You is available to watch on all major video on-demand platforms. Thank you all so much for watching and tuning in. You can head over to latinbabbler.com for more of our content, reviews, articles, podcasts, and more.
Give the show a follow at The Latin Babbler Show on Instagram. And you can follow me at Cosmo Latina Cares.
And you can follow me at Juan Ayala Official. That's it for us today, folks. Thank you so much again. We are out. Desde Nicaragua hasta Costa Rica, con esta canción todo mundo se identifica. Llamen a los chilenos y a los cubanos, llamen a Puerto Rico y a los mexicanos, que ya se armó la rumba. Desde Panamá hasta Ecuador, vámonos a Perú y luego hasta Salvador. Que se escuche Brasil y Argentina, yo quiero un grito de mi gente latina. Y levantaré mi bandera, estando en mi país o estando allá afuera. Porque para mí mira, no existen fronteras.